The following podcast is brought to you by the Jonas Podcasting Network, found exclusively at WrestlingWithJonas.com. And welcome to the latest episode of Wrestling with Jonas, episode 256. Can you believe that? And we're motoring closer to our fourth anniversary, which is just a month or so away. But today, I've got to say that they say in life, never to meet your heroes. But today I've got one of my wrestling heroes on the podcast, Mr. Finlay Martin from the Power Slam podcast and the Power Slam magazine. How are you doing, sir?
I'm doing really well. Thanks for having me on your show.
Oh, it's my pleasure, my pleasure. And I was speaking to Finn off air, and if anybody knows me as a wrestling fan, they know that I raved about Power Slam magazine when it was out from 1994 to 2014, wasn't it, Finn? And 20 yes. long years of the Power Slam podcast. Obviously, it was preceded by the Superstars of Wrestling magazine for a couple of years before that. But first of all, how are you doing?
I'm doing really well, yeah. And I'd just like to thank you for buying the magazine. For all those years, 30 issues of Superstars of Wrestling from Jan 92 through to June of 94. And then all 237 issues of Power Slam, I believe.
Absolutely.
From July 94 through to July 2014. So, and also you even ran the hotline back in the day.
I did. I'll tell you more about that later on. But don't regret a single moment of the money I spent on Power Slam over the years. And we'll get into the reasons why very soon. But Finn, I want to ask you about what you're up to nowadays, because obviously the magazine closed its doors, unfortunately, 8 years ago now.
Yeah,
that seems incredible. 2014.
Yeah, 8 years ago last month. It's... July 17th was the on sale date of issue 237, and it's it didn't feel like 8 years. You know, I didn't really do anything to celebrate it or to commiserate the occasion, but it doesn't feel like 8 years. So that's kind of strange. But I'm involved now with Inside the Ropes magazine, which
there we go. There's the latest edition
there. That's been around issue. Issue 24 goes on sale this Thursday with Vince McMahon on the cover. Obviously, who else?
Yes.
Vince.
Lots to talk about in that magazine, I'm sure. Plenty of news about Vince.
Yeah, so I'm doing the podcast with Inside the Ropes. And, after the magazine closed, Rope Pro Wrestling through the Power Slam years, which came out in September 2015. That was my first book, and then I did two further books, Power Slam Interviews Volume 1 and Power Slam Interviews Volume 2. But yeah, now it's the magazine. I'm not running it. I'm just a contributor. So I do like a column and a Q&A in the news section. And in the next issue, I'm going to be doing the review of Clash at the Castle, which I'm really looking forward to. I'm sure everyone listening to this or watching this is looking forward to the show, as am I. I think it'll be a really good show, and I'm looking forward to doing the write-up as well. So, yeah, I'm not as busy as I was, which I'm grateful for at my age. I'm 50. How old am I now? 52 I am. And back in the day when I was running Power Slam, it was really long hours. Still full-time job, but it's not full-time plus.
Exactly.
And at my age, I'm very pleased about it.
We're going to take a deep dive into Power Slam, how it all started, and those are really long shifts that you would pull just to get the edition out before deadline day, Finn. But this is obviously what you was referring to earlier, Power Slam, Pro Wrestling through the Power Slam years, and of course your two subsequent books, Volume 1 and Volume 2 of the Power Slam interviews. Finn, we are here primarily to talk about 30 years of SummerSlam 92. Now, it was probably the second wrestling show I ever went to. I think the first one was earlier on that year. I think they did a WrestleMania revenge tour over in the UK. And that was my first taste of American wrestling, of WWF back in the day. I think that was the NEC in Birmingham.
How old would you have been then?
Oh, I was 16 years old in 92. Or I was probably 15 then and 16 when SummerSlam came around, because my birthday's in July. But as I was telling you off air, I probably caught World of Sport Wrestling with my nan every Saturday afternoon or the Saturdays when I would go around there, and first became a big fan in around about 91 of American wrestling, of WWF, of course. But 92 was kind of the pivotal year in my wrestling fandom. But when you kind of think back to those kind of heady heights of WWF back in 92 and that summer that gave us the Wembley version, the Wembley edition of SummerSlam, what are your initial thoughts and recollections then, Finn?
Well, I mean, I remember at first thinking, oh, they're never gonna sell Wembley Stadium out, and it just showed a real lack of imagination on my part, because you know the tours they were running then, they were like selling out everywhere. They were only like 7 or 8 day tours. You know, it'd be Glasgow, it'd be Manchester, it'd be Birmingham, it'd be London, even go down to like places like Brighton
and across Europe
as well. Obviously, Germany a few years later was when they really caught fire. I think about 94. I think was the that was when Bret Hart was like the big star over there.
He was God reincarnated over there, wasn't he? He was a huge
I can't remember whether they did 6 or 7 separate tours that year. I did work it out recently for the Q&A section of Inside the Ropes magazine. But I mean, yeah, SummerSlam, it did feel huge, and when you think about it, with them filling all those like 8, 9, 10, 12 thousand, like Sheffield Arena was a really big venue. I remember going to see WCW there in their famous, rather infamous Raw Power Tour in December of 1991. Ooh. And there was less than 1,000 people in, I think it was a 12,000 seat venue. And it was a funereal atmosphere. It was just depressing. And I think it was December 13th, 1991. It's Friday as well. And I always remember that day because I got fired from my old job on that day as well.
Oh, a very ominous day.
And then the very next one, Superstars of Wrestling started. So for me, it was an amazing sort of experience that they could sell, or amazing achievement that they could sell Wembley Stadium out, or at least it felt like it at the time. But if you applied simple mathematics, of course they were going to be able to sell 80,000 tickets. You know, they could, on a tour, they'd sell like, I don't know, 60, 70,000 tickets. And you had people coming from Europe. I mean, some people would have flown over from the States and Canada for the event. So, I mean, and there would have been people who wouldn't have gone to a show, say, the NEC in Birmingham or the GMEX in Manchester or the Wembley Arena in London, who would have gone to the Wembley Stadium show because it was such an event, for the novelty of attending an event at a stadium. So, yeah, it stood to reason when you thought about it for more than a nanosecond that, yeah, of course they were going to be able to fill the venue. And I can't remember how quickly the tickets sold out. I think I read somewhere it's like 10 hours, but I think it was probably more than that, because back then, of course, you had to ring up for tickets.
No internet.
Yeah. I mean, internet did exist, but almost like who had it? Very few people. I knew someone who had it, but obviously it was really slow dial up, and things like, you know, you couldn't buy tickets for events over the internet in 1992. So absolutely. I don't know whether it actually was that quick, but it was a very fast sellout. Can you remember how you got tickets?
It's a funny story, because back in 92, I didn't have a home phone. My dad didn't own a credit card. So I was thinking to myself, how on earth am I going to get tickets for SummerSlam? Fortunately, my uncle, who lived next door to my parents' house, did have a telephone, did have a credit card that he was prepared to purchase the tickets on, remarkably. And he did begrudgingly agree to get tickets for me, my dad, and two of our friends. And back then they were much more reasonably priced than they are now, but still, when you've got four tickets going through on an uncle's credit card, using his phone, you know, for long periods of that day to, you know, make sure that you got to the front of the queue to eventually get your tickets, it was a big deal. So we were kind of up against it to start off with. But one thing I wanted to throw your way, Finn, was originally SummerSlam 92 was not set to take place in London, was it? And I've got it down here that it was going to take place originally in the Capital Centre in Landover, Maryland. And they did kind of, I don't know whether they initially promoted it to be taking place there. And then it got switched to Wembley. And I know tickets went on sale, I think it was in June, so probably only a couple of months out from the show. The promotion was very, very quick. But originally, it wasn't scheduled to take place at Wembley at all.
That's right. Yeah, that's right. I mean, lots of people have taken credit for the suggestion to hold it in England. I know Bret Hart has, and he's said that he told Vince McMahon that if they were to hold the event there, because I think it was originally going to be Bret versus Shawn in the main event.
Absolutely. I believe,
or maybe not the main event. It was probably going to be Warrior Savage in the main event, because technically, as far as American fans were concerned, on the pay-per-view, Warrior versus Savage was promoted as the main event in the venue that night, or in the stadium that night, as I'm sure you remember. And everyone who was there, and most fans in the UK, viewed British Bulldog David Boy Smith challenging Intercontinental Champion Bret Hart as the main event. And that went on last.
Yeah.
But had it taken place in the States, in Landover, Maryland, I think it would have been Bret Shawn for the IC belt, I believe.
That was what was originally slated. And I've also heard subsequently, and I can't remember what report or how I found this out, but the original plan was for Shawn to go over in that match. Like I say, obviously with how hot, how rabid the fans were for WWF in 92, like say from 1991, 92 onwards, it just grew to a fever pitch over here in the UK. It grew to a fever pitch across Europe. And as you mentioned, I think off air, but when Bret Hart was the face of the company in 93 and 94 across Europe, it just went even more crazy. And they did an astonishing amount of tours across Europe. But that was probably the most perfect time that the WWF could have possibly have done a big show like that during that era in 1992. So it made the best possible sense ever.
Yeah, it was just simple economics. And I think they just, WWF or Vince McMahon just did what, you know, I just spelled out earlier. He did the simple maths. It's like, hold on a minute, you know, we're selling like 50,000-60,000 tickets on a tour. We can probably fill Wembley, you know, and we're not going to be able to sell 50,000 tickets in America, in the States, because they're obviously really struggling in 1992 for various reasons. Hogan had gone in the sex scandals, the steroid scandal, you know, the company was waning. But in the UK, it was at craze levels of popularity, wasn't it? It was like the BMXs, or probably before your time, skateboards in the 1970s, or, you know, New Kids on the Block, whatever. Something that really burns very brightly for a short time. And the belief, I think, amongst many, and, you know, it was a fear of mine as well, was, you know, are people going to be really into this? And then are they just going to lose interest, like in 93 or 94, and it's just going to, sky's going to drop it. My magazine's not going to exist. I'm going to have to go and get a real job. So it was certainly, you know, a perfect time for them to run the stadium event. And, you know, I think the idea of Bret defending against Davey Boy Smith, that was the perfect match to headline the show with, at least locally. Davey Boy Smith was massively popular, as you'll remember. So, yeah, it just all made sense, didn't it? It's like, had SummerSlam 92 taken place in Landover, Maryland, we wouldn't be talking about it now, would we?
I don't think so. No, we certainly wouldn't be as passionate about that show as we are now. But some pictures from the day. And I was always familiar with Wembley hosting FA Cup finals and huge concerts. But when the WWF came to town in August, I think it was August the 29th, 1992, which is an anniversary that we haven't reached yet, despite the fact that they've already held this year's version of SummerSlam on July the 30th, so a few weeks ago. And of course, we're in the build-up to Clash at the Castle, the first major pay-per-view or premium live event in 30 years since SummerSlam 92, which is why it kind of makes us reminisce even more about what a fantastic occasion SummerSlam 92 was in Wembley all them years ago. And another question for you, Finn, is why do you think it's taken the WWF or WWE 30 years to give us another event of this scale once again over on UK shores?
I don't really know the answer to that question. I've often thought about that. I mean, they've obviously toured and they ran the UK-only pay-per-view starting with One Night Only in September of 97, which was obviously a big success. I was there for that. Were you there for that show?
I was not. No, I missed the UK only pay-per-views. I went to a lot of the house shows when they toured, but not the pay-per-views.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, that was in Birmingham, wasn't it? I'm sure it was in Birmingham. Yeah, I think it was September 20th, 1997. That date is imprinted in my memory. Hopefully that's right. But then, that was a big success on Sky Box Office at the time, or at least by the standards, of the time. And then they got into a pattern of doing two a year, didn't they?
I remember Insurrection. Was that one of them?
Yeah, Insurrection and No Mercy. And then there was Mayhem in Manchester. I don't think that actually was shown on Sky Box Office. I think that was just a house show. But yeah, they settled into a pattern of doing two a year. And, it was diminishing returns. I mean, they were not promoted on US TV. They were added extras. I mean, I remember one time there was a sign in the crowd which read, "Nothing of significance will happen tonight." And that just summed it up.
And they were right.
Exactly. The only title would change hands would be the hardcore title, which would then change hands again before the show ended, so they didn't have to acknowledge it on Raw two nights later. Then they got into also a pattern of running Raw and SmackDown tapings twice a year. And maybe they just thought that they couldn't fill the venue. I think also when they were running pay-per-views, there was the whole problem of the time difference, wasn't there?
Yes.
So, I mean, we should point out actually now, SummerSlam 92 was held in the UK on August 29th, 1992. And it was screened on pay-per-view in America on August 31st, 92, on the Monday night. Obviously, this was pre-internet. I mean, hotlines existed and things like that. And they, I can't remember whether they said that it was live, but they probably didn't say that it was pre-taped. I can't remember how they handled that at the time. But they could get away with it back then because most people wouldn't have known the results from an event that took place in London. So there was, still a healthy pay-per-view audience, or at least by the standards of the time, for the show when it broadcast on Monday. So I think, the simple answer to the question is, when they were running pay-per-views, there was a problem with the time difference. If you held it at like 7 o'clock UK time, then America's like East Coast, like 5 hours behind, isn't it?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
So that would then start at 2 p.m. Eastern time. And, American fans probably want the live pay-per-view to go out at 7 p.m. Eastern time.
Absolutely.
And obviously when the internet's around, people can look up the results. And if they know the results, they're going to be disinclined to order the event. So I think it was probably that was a factor as well. And now we're in this network era. It's not as important, is it? I mean, they've already got the money. So Absolutely. If something's pre-taped, people are not going to unsubscribe because an event is held at a different, it's broadcast at a funny time. They can watch it whenever they want, can't they, on the network?
Absolutely. And I mean, for myself, I have a lot of memories of that show at Wembley, SummerSlam 92. But one thing that really stands out to me was, I mean, obviously you've got this vast stadium and this huge walkway or aisleway. And some of the entrances from that year's SummerSlam was very, very memorable. You obviously had the Undertaker came down to his match on the back of a hearse, which was very memorable. The Legion of Doom coming down on a harness.
Certainly more memorable than his match with Kamala.
Well, we'll get onto that a bit later on. But obviously you had the LOD come down in their Harleys with Paul Ellering and Rocco. That kind of ruined it for me. And so many more. Obviously, British Bulldog being flag waved to the ring by Lennox Lewis and Shawn Michaels and Sherry with that huge mirror. So many kind of memorable entrances. But I think Wembley kind of lent itself to the grandeur and to allow WWF to really go overboard with some of the entrances that year, didn't it?
Sure, absolutely. But I mean, from that image that you just showed, or the images you showed just a moment ago, and I was watching some of SummerSlam 92 again today in preparation for this recording, and it does seem really primitive looking back, because obviously it's 30 years ago, but at the time, this was high tech, this was state of the art, and absolutely, especially for two people who grew up on, I mean, I watched British wrestling in, Catford Town Hall and places like that. And that was, that's what attracted me to American wrestling in the first place, because it was so much bigger and brighter and bolder and brassier, and it's in these massive venues, and you're like, wow, this is like, you know, to me, it was almost like it was like a difference between like a blockbuster Hollywood movie and like an Amdram production, you know, or a, you know, production at your local theater, if you live in like a, you know, local town or whatever, you know, like a 500 seat theater and like an event at MSG. I mean, there was such a disparity, wasn't there, in the budgets and just the whole presentation between American wrestling and British wrestling at the time, which was the huge part of the reason why I became a fan. I'm sure it was the reason why so many other people became fans in this country, because it was just unlike anything we'd ever seen. You look at Wembley, and yeah, the production now does seem, you know, really kind of low key. But at the time, I remember that overhead shot they had. They had like that overhead shot on whatever it was. Wouldn't have been a drone, would have been before a drone. That shot there. And you're just like, wow, look at this. You know, there's all those people there to watch pro wrestling. And as you say, Legion of Doom, they kicked off the pay-per-view, riding down to the ring on the rented Harley Davidsons. With Paul Ellering, you had Rocco on the front, the ventriloquist. Apparently, hated that. Apparently, they absolutely loathed that gimmick.
The fans hated it. I hated it.
And yeah, Undertaker being driven down to the ring on the back of a hearse. And it's just like, it was somewhat larger than life. It was what we wanted, wasn't it? It was like, it just felt incredible.
Yeah, absolutely.
But I mean, I'm sure Clash at the Castle, I mean, I can't wait to see what they've got in store for that. That's going to look amazing as well.
Oh, absolutely. When you look at some of the stages that they put together for some of these big pay-per-views, WrestleMania, and what they could possibly dream up for that castle show. Watching it back on Sky Sports two nights later, and subsequently on VHS and DVD, Finn, one thing that really jumped out to me was the commentary. And I think we all love Bobby the Brain Heenan, whoever he sat next to, Gorilla Monsoon, Vince McMahon, or whichever partner he has next to him at the commentary desk. But I think when people think about Bobby the Brain Heenan's commentary kind of golden shows, they think about the Royal Rumble 92, possibly even WrestleMania that year. A lot of people don't always think about how brilliant Bobby the Brain Heenan was at SummerSlam 92, and especially being alongside Vince and with the UK audience. But Bobby was on fire again for this show, wasn't he? And probably one of them performances a lot of people may not remember as fondly as the Rumble or maybe WrestleMania from that same year, Finn.
Yeah, I agree. Yeah, I mean, because his performance during the Rumble match, because he was rooting for Ric Flair, and every time he looked like Flair was going to be eliminated, he was, and then of course when Flair was number two, wasn't it? I think it was the number two entrant, wasn't it? Number one, number two. He started the match.
DiBiase and Davey Boy is number one and two, and then Flair came out third, didn't he? So he was the first. Final? Yeah, first one with the cowbell. Yes, please continue.
Yeah. Sorry, but it's Flair, it's like, I can't believe it, you know, he's drawn the short straw here, and you're right, Heenan was amazing during that match, and I think also WrestleMania that year as well, because of his, you know, emotional attachment, his vested interest in Ric Flair and the whole Randy Savage storyline, with Savage defeating Flair for the belt at WrestleMania 8 that year, and Heenan went crazy over that. So it was a different performance here at SummerSlam. But, I mean, at this point, Heenan was really sharp. He was really into it. I mean, you could tell that he was interested in the job. I mean, it's a shame if you watch or listen to any of his commentary performances in WCW towards the end of the 90s. I mean, he was just, I mean, talk about phoning it in. I mean, it was kind of miserable, really, to relive a lot of his commentary performances, really, especially from 99 before he was replaced in 2000. But certainly back in 92, yeah, you're right, he was on fire. He was so sharp. And just so invested in the product as well, and the characters. And I just think as time wore on, he just became jaded and indifferent to it all. And WCW did have that effect on some people. But I think also, you know, that happens to a lot of people in wrestling, is that, you know, the business changes and it's not relatable to them anymore, you know, and that's just what happens to certain people. Hopefully it won't happen to me. Maybe it's already happened to me. I haven't noticed yet. I realised.
Not as far as I'm concerned, Finn. But
there's a serious point there. There's a serious point. I mean, to meet Jim Ross on AEW, yeah. I just think he's detached from the product many weeks. But Heenan, going back to SummerSlam 92, he was committed, dedicated, disciplined, dynamic. The three Ds.
Absolutely. And very, very funny. Yeah. So if you haven't watched SummerSlam 92 for a long time, like Finn did this morning and like I did yesterday, revisit it. Like I said, we're going to talk about the undercard in a minute. But even during the undercard, Bobby the Brain Heenan makes them almost bearable, to be honest with you. But let's talk about some of the undercard matches, because they were typical of that era. They were typical of WWF in 1992. There was a lot of clangers, wasn't there? I mean, Nails versus Virgil, Undertaker, Kamala, even some of the tag matches like the Beverly Brothers and the Natural Disasters. And dare I say, even LOD and Money Inc. was a bit of a letdown for various reasons. Those matches, like I say, we don't really want to go into too much detail about their matches, but they weren't anything special. Now, to those watching them in the stadium that day, it was just all part of the fantastic occasion, and the fans were fully invested into every second of what's going on. But those matches, when we talk about matches that kind of live up to today, those didn't really live up to the standard of 92, did they? It was quite poor matches on the undercard.
Yeah, I think that's fair to say. Yeah, I mean, I remember my first WWF show was March of 91 at the GMEX in Manchester. And I mean, the crowds were so easy back then, you know, the British fans. And it was like Greg Valentine, and I can't remember who was on the show, but the talent just weren't doing anything. Just basically just took the night off. And I mean, it was the greatest paydays in sinning years, the WWF stars, because our ticket prices were much higher in the UK than they were in the States at the time. The venues were filled, but they didn't really have to do much in the ring. So, I mean, it must have been amazing for the talent coming over here and working those shows. I mean, they get away with taking hardly any bumps, because the fans were just thrilled to see these huge stars that they marveled at on Sky TV each week. And I think the same, to an extent, applied at SummerSlam. It was such a novelty being in that huge stadium and seeing an event of this magnitude that I think they actually got away with presenting so many, you know, mediocre or even lousy matches. I mean, Virgil versus Nails was kind of a squash, and it served its purpose, didn't it? At that point, Nails was in the feud with the Big Boss Man, who wasn't there. I believe he was selling the injuries from the attack, wasn't he, at that point?
Quite right, absolutely.
I believe. Can you imagine someone doing that now? Well, he would do, actually.
And then they had that legendary nightstick on a pole match at Survivor Series. I think that was the payoff to that feud, and Nails didn't really last much longer after that, I think.
Yeah, Nails didn't last much longer after that. But let's not get into the reasons why Nails didn't last much longer than that.
That's for another podcast.
Yeah, absolutely. But you're right. I mean, like Kamala versus Undertaker, I mean, it was a really short match. I think I've got it written down here. It was like, here we go, 3 minutes and 27 seconds.
The Undertaker's entrance was longer than the match, I believe, in.
Yeah.
Oh, it wouldn't surprise me if it was.
maybe it was for the best. Because had it gone longer, it probably would have been even worse.
Absolutely.
So, I mean, we're just thinking of us by trimming the match. We don't want a protracted match between Kamala and The Undertaker. It's going to be dismal. I've got to say, you know, watching Beverly Brothers versus the Natural Disasters, Earthquake and Typhoon did sell for those guys. They really did. And I forgot about that they actually, those big guys, would actually sell for smaller opponents. Mm. So, I mean, that could have been worse. DiBiase, I think, did a really good job against Hawk and Animal. Hawk, as I'm sure a lot of people know, went into the ring under the influence of drugs.
Yeah.
You'll see at the end where I think Animal has to shove Hawk out of the way to do the power slam finish.
That's right.
And Hawk at one point is actually, I think he thought they were doing the doomsday device for the finish and climbed up to the top rope, and then they didn't do the doomsday device.
For good reason. Yeah.
Yeah. You know, you should never have even climbed to the top rope.
No.
And in the end, I think Animal just hit I think it was just a power slam for the finish.
And there we go. So, I mean, that was probably one of the better undercard matches, let's be honest. Yeah. But one match I was particularly looking forward to was Shawn Michaels versus Rick Martel. Now, on paper, you know, as a wrestling fan, like say, I was a teenager at the time, 16, and I was getting less into the characters and more into the actual wrestling. And this match excited me in particular because you had, let's be honest, two of the best workers, two of the best technical wrestlers on the roster in 1992. Yeah. But it was kind of overshadowed and, dare I say, it slightly ruined with a very poor stipulation that kind of meant that they couldn't hit each other in the face.
Yeah.
And Sherry was involved an awful lot. And it turned into a bit of a nothing match. So, I mean, besides Brett and Davey Boy, this was probably the second biggest match I was looking forward to because of the technical abilities of the two wrestlers in the ring. And probably the biggest disappointment for me, in my opinion, Finn.
Yeah, you're right. It was more like a comedy match, wasn't it? And Sherry was at ringside and the camera lingered on her and like she was beside herself. Oh, no, they're going to punch each other in the face and ruin each other's looks because it was Rick the Model Martel. And this was pre-Heartbreak Kid, wasn't it? This was the boy toy era, wasn't
that's
it?
Right. That's right.
I mean, the best thing that Sherry did, I mean, Sherry had been great as a manager, as Randy Savage's manager. I'm not really sure that she was really added that much to the Shawn Michaels act. I think they thought that he needed something extra after he'd turned heel on Marty and had the new character. So I understand why they put Sherry with Shawn in 92. But to me, I thought her greatest contribution to Shawn Michaels' act at that time was her vocals on the song.
You're not wrong. Yeah, absolutely. That was the better version, I thought. they should have kept that.
Yeah, that's it. And so you're right. It was more like a comedy match. I mean, Rick Martel was a guy who obviously had a really good reputation in the AWA when he was champion. And, you know, he was really good in Strikeforce. Well, actually, it was the Can-Am connection at first, wasn't it, with Tom Zenk. And then Tom Zenk quit. And then it was Rick Martel and Tito Santana.
Tito, absolutely.
Yeah, so, you know, he had that good run in the tag team there. But I think by 92, he was, you know, the character was doing most of the heavy lifting, wasn't it? You know, and I think he realized that in order for him to really make it as a singles player, he had to ham it up. You know, absolutely. And that was the character. There was so much ham there, wasn't there? Yes, I am a model. And he had his arrogance spray and, you know, he'd had that feud with Jake Roberts.
Jake Roberts, that's it, WrestleMania 7.
I mean, you know, Rick Martel, he hadn't really given us that many classic matches, had he, as a single guy?
No. I think the character kind of overtook what, you know, technical ability was there. But as I said about a lot of the undercard matches, Finn, it was kind of a match of its time. And it was WWF back then was very much about the characters, was very much about the gimmicks, and was very much about the comedy, more so than the technical ability and the great matches they could have put on. But we'll get onto that classic match that finished the show a bit later on. What are your memories of the WWF title match between Randy Savage and the Ultimate Warrior? Because once again, that was saddled going into the show with an added stipulation about Mr. Perfect, which corner would he be in? And it was going to be revealed on the night. And of course, Ric Flair in tow as well. And the match was quite a long match, I thought. It went nearly 30 minutes. But to any particular thoughts on that match? And did you enjoy that match? Was you happy with the way it was booked?
Well, I mean, it did seem odd, didn't it, that Flair and Perfect, obviously Flair and Perfect came out during the match, but it was odd that Flair did not wrestle on the show. That was curious. Why was Flair not on that show? And I'm sure he was miffed that he wasn't booked on the show. I mean, the problem was Warrior versus Savage from WrestleMania 7 was still fairly fresh in mind. And that had been so good. And there were stakes in that match were so high. And it was kind of, how was it going to measure up to the brilliance of that match? And with it being a retirement match, of course, Savage ended up returning. But we didn't know that when we watched WrestleMania 7, that Savage was going to return to wrestling. And I think a lot of us, certainly you, I'm sure me as well, were not as au fait with the whole retirement thing back then. You know, when a wrestler said he was going to retire, you sort of believe that he or she would.
Absolutely. And
it's not like now where you know that they're probably not going to honor the right retirement stipulation. So I think that really hindered it, the fact that we all still remembered WrestleMania 7 and that was a better match. How were they going to possibly top that? I mean, I enjoyed the match. I thought it was well done for what it was. I think it was certainly one of Warrior's best matches. I mean, you could say, well, that's not saying much. But, I mean, I think it was pretty good. And I think Warrior did well in it. As I understand it, it was, they worked it out in advance. You know, Savage was famous for this. Obviously, he'd done it with the Steamboat match. And he did this with many other opponents as well, that he would actually lay his matches out in advance, which was very unusual in the 80s. But as far as I know, the 92 SummerSlam match between Warrior and Savage, they kind of laid it out move for move in advance, which possibly would explain why it was as good as it was. Yeah. But it was, yeah, it was a non-finish, wasn't it?
It Power was. Pick. A double DQ or something like that, but
it was a count out. Warrior beat Savage by count out when
right.
Flair yeah. had struck. Flair was at ringside with a chair and he struck Randy Savage in the knee, didn't he?
Yeah, and there was all sorts of shenanigans going on, and
and that played
with interference at the end. There,
then they had the title match, didn't they, at the TV taping a few days later. And the knee injury played into the finish of that match. And Razor Ramon, that was Razor Ramon's big moment as well, because he was involved in the finish. And then Flair defeated Savage for the belt.
Absolutely. And at the time, I was a huge Ric Flair fan, although I'd only been into the American style wrestling, WWF, for about approximately a year to that point. Like I say, we saw Ric Flair come in with the real world championship belt, didn't we, towards the back end of 91. And then, of course, that legendary Rumble match and the fantastic match he had with Savage at WrestleMania 8. And this was only the next pay-per-view along in that year, because remember, we only had four pay-per-views that year. I was as surprised as anybody as to why Ric Flair didn't have a match of his own. I'm not quite sure how he would have fitted in. Obviously, they had their mind set on Savage versus Ultimate Warrior, a rematch from the year prior. But that will always be one of the kind of unsolved mysteries as to why Ric Flair was only there in like a bit part instead of having a match of his own, considering the fantastic pay-per-views he had earlier on that year.
Absolutely. I mean, he could have had a match and then he could have still done the running, couldn't he? And he could have done the attack on Savage and that would have still led to the title match at the TV taping a few days later in which Flair became champ for a second time.
Absolutely. Let's talk about the main event then, because even to this day, I still remember vividly that three count and before that, what a fantastic match it was and how back and forth it was, how into the match the entire 80,000 fans in Wembley Arena, Wembley Stadium was into that match. And we even when I watched it back yesterday, we speak about matches kind of that day of 1992, not living up to standard, being more character driven. But even 30 years on, that main event, Finn, still lives up to today's standards, in my opinion. And if you were to put that into a 2022 pay-per-view, it would be still probably there or thereabouts the best match on the card. But watching it back yesterday, it didn't disappoint me. It's probably the 50th time that I've seen that match in total. What about yourself?
Yeah, I mean, the atmosphere was amazing, wasn't it? And we had the story as well, because they'd only recently divulged or disclosed on the air that Davey and Brett were brothers-in-law.
Correct.
You know, obviously, Davey was married to Diana, who was Brett's sister. So that was like the added layer to the story, wasn't it? The added strand to this. And, you know, who was Brett's sister going to side with? And then, you know, it was, you know, family feud, you know, it's like tearing the family apart. So I think that really did resonate with fans as well, because it felt suddenly more real, didn't it?
Yeah.
That these two people who, because like most WWE, most fans in the UK discovered WWF in 1989 when Sky launched. Obviously, WWF had been on cable prior to that. And that was when I discovered it. I discovered it in 88. and it had briefly been on ITV as well. But I mean, most fans who were in Wembley Stadium would not have seen any of the British Bulldogs versus Hart Foundation matches in, like, you know, 86, 87. Most of them, they might have been aware that those matches had taken place, but they probably hadn't seen them. So this whole thing with Brett, you know, because Brett was a baby face when most fans discovered him in this country. And then Davey returned in late 1990, wasn't it, when he returned as a single?
It was, because he was definitely involved in the 91 Royal Rumble and WrestleMania that year. So it would have been late 90 when he returned as a singles, correct?
That's right. Actually, I don't think he was on WrestleMania 7. I think he'd been booked, but I don't think he was on the show.
I thought he fought the Warlord that year.
But
anyway, I could be wrong.
Definitely fought the Warlord at this Tuesday in Texas.
Right. Maybe I'm getting my events mixed up then.
I think
somebody will correct us. If you're watching live at home, check Wikipedia, because I can't, and send us a comment. Let us know. But we digress anyway.
Yes. So we had this story of these two, because it was babyface versus babyface, wasn't it? That's the point I'm driving at. Yeah, and those matches were rare in those days, weren't they?
Absolutely.
Especially main events. I mean, obviously we'd had Warrior Hogan at WrestleMania 6, but I mean, you know, that was an aberration. That was an anomaly. They didn't happen very often. So to see this in the main event, I think it was really good that WWF jazzed it up with this family storyline. And that really, I thought, added a hell of a lot of emotion to it. I think also we should point out just how much the Intercontinental title meant back then. And I'm very pleased to see in recent weeks that WWE, since Paul Levesque took over as creative supremo, you know, a huge push has been made again to make the IC title feel prestigious with the, you know, Gunther versus Nakamura match and five-way match on SmackDown last week, which Sheamus won, and he'll face Gunther at Clash at the Castle. Sorry, I just had to cough then.
That's right, you carry on. I know you've had a bad throat over recent weeks, so take as many breaks as you need.
I wasn't on last week, I couldn't speak. So
we are lucky to have you this week.
Yeah, so I mean, it was an amazing match, amazing atmosphere. I think all those factors really contributed to the success of the match, but you are absolutely right that the match itself over-delivered, you know, on an industrial scale. I mean, that was such an amazing performance by both. You know, and as Brett pointed out in his autobiography, most people will know this, Davey was not in great shape going into that match. You know, he had a lot of drug problems, he had a lot of injury problems. So, I mean, Brett had to do a hell of a lot of work to prepare Davey for that match. Now, the only thing that slightly spoils it for me is that knowledge, when you know that Brett's there, basically leading Davey through the match.
Spot by spot, absolutely.
If you watch, you can see Brett calling the spots. And he was the master at that. You'd never see him talking. You'd never see him communicating with his opponent. And unfortunately, when you know that he is, you see it. So that, I've got to say, last time I watched it, that rather, you know, didn't spoil it for me, but tarnished it ever so slightly, but still an incredible match. And I remember on the night, the atmosphere was, I've never experienced anything like that before or since live. No. It was just the most amazing thing. And I still hold that up as, you know, the greatest reaction I've ever seen to a title victory ever. You know, and that's saying something when you think of how over Austin was in like 98 and 99, and how over Hogan was, and all these other people over the years who've been massively popular. But it was, an incredible experience just to see Davey win that belt and then celebrate with Brett afterwards. And, you know, was Brett going to hand him the belt? You know, what was Brett's sister going to do? What was Davey's wife going to do? Who was she going to side with? And I just think it was, you know, it couldn't have been more perfect, I don't think.
No. I think had that match not have been as good, Finn, then I don't think that SummerSlam 92 as a whole would be as beloved as it possibly is now. But it really was a tremendous match. And out of interest, whereabouts were you sat in the stadium for the show and to witness that match?
I was on the floor. I had pretty good seats. I was on the floor, I don't know, maybe about 20 rows back, something like that. It wasn't a bad spot. I mean, I've sat ringside for wrestling shows, and only, I think, once or twice, and I never do now, because you can hear them talking to each other, and it right. just ruins it. It just, you know, you're in there, you want to get your suspension of disbelief goggles on, and it just, and that just spoils it for me. You know, if you can hear people calling spots or communicating with each other in a match. So I like to sit back, and then you can get into the show, and you can believe, you know, sink into, you know, immerse yourself in the atmosphere. Yeah. And I really enjoy doing that. You know, to this day, I still, you know, when I watch pro wrestling, I you know, it's not so much you want to believe, because of course you know, but it's like you want to get sucked into the story that's being told. Yeah. And I think I did on the night. I remember thinking it was a masterpiece that they were assembling in the ring. But yeah, the atmosphere was such a huge part of that as well. And you go back and you watch it, and you're just like, you know, you're still in awe, right? You're having seen, as you say, you've seen it how many times? 50 times, did you say? I must have seen that match at least half a dozen times, maybe more. Yeah. And it's like watching a classic film, you know, that classic film, whatever your favorite classic film is, you know, it's a classic film if you can watch it like every year and still enjoy it. And that's how you know this was a classic match, because you can revisit it once a year or once every 2 years or whatever. And it's still mesmerizing. You know, it's 100%. You're still like hypnotized by the brilliance on display. You just don't look at Bret Hart's lips. Don't worry. Yep. Just ignore
what Bret's and the other fascinating thing coming out of that match and coming out of SummerSlam is that both David Boy and Bret Hart's careers kind of went off in slightly different directions. And I think, from my opinion, Finn, Davey Boy's career never really reached them heights ever again. And of course, you know, he lost the IC title at a Saturday night's main event against Shawn Michaels, I think in about October of 92, shortly went off to WCW, came back to WWF in 94, I believe. And of course, he had a couple of European Championship reigns. I think he could possibly have been the first ever European champion. He had another tag team championship reign with Owen Hart. Yeah. But, and I know he was involved in some WWF title matches against Shawn Michaels, I think around 96 or 97, but they never really pushed a button on Davey Boy Smith following SummerSlam like they did on that night. And I don't know whether it's because they didn't really see that he could take it to that next level, never really saw him as a world champion, but they never really pushed a button on Davey Boy again following that IC title run, did they?
I think you are right there. I mean, in some ways, probably the highlight of his second run, or rather it would be his third run, wouldn't it? Because he obviously had the first run, 84 to 88, and then came back in 90, and then it was 90 to 92, and then it was 94 to 97, wasn't it? Oh, no, that's not right. He came back in 99, didn't he, for that very regrettable run?
Yes.
Do you remember that? He came back in doing four runs in total. I mean, he should not have been in the ring in 1999. He could not even take flat back bumps.
No, he was in a bad shape, most definitely.
Yeah, I mean, that was really tragic to see him in the ring in 99.
But even in 97, being part of the Hart Foundation, that was certainly a highlight. Yeah. But he was part player of that faction, wasn't he? He wasn't the number one guy. He possibly wasn't even the number two guy in that faction in 97. And that's only 5 years departed from that glorious night at Wembley. But he never quite reached those heights again, did he?
He didn't, no. So he came back in 94 as a babyface. And then he formed the Allied Powers with Lex Luger. And that didn't really get over. Then he turned heel in autumn of 95. No, it wasn't. Summer of 95, he turned heel, and that was really shocking that Davey would turn. And then in 97, he won the European title. It was Davey versus Owen, wasn't it, in the tournament final in Germany. Correct. Incredible match. If you haven't seen that match, Feb 97, I think it was, that is one to track down. That was... could have been the last, you know, truly amazing singles match of Davey's career. I think we've got to give him a lot of credit for the Canadian Stampede match, the 10-man.
Oh, wow. Yeah.
And he housed that July. But I mean, again, that was, it was the atmosphere that was the driver that made that so such a hypnotic affair. And with the Hart Foundation, who were heels in the States, but were baby faces in Calgary. And just what a dynamic one-man performance from Steve Austin in that match, him playing heel.
And that whole pay-per-view was still one of the best pay-per-views ever. That as a show lives up to you know, to its standards even today. But
agreed,
fantastic, agreed. Fantastic match.
Agreed. But then we come to One Night Only, which we talked about earlier, September '97, and he had this amazing main event match with Shawn Michaels and Sean Beaton for the European title, and that was a very controversial decision. Davey didn't want to lose the belt. Brett was against it, you know, Sean had the power, and, you know, the word at the time was that Sean would win the belt, then he would drop it back to Davey in April 98 in Manchester. Obviously, Sean had retired by then, suffered the back injury, the double cross had occurred, Davey Boy Smith was in WCW, so there was no rematch. But I remember being there that night, and that was an extraordinary matchup, and there was, like, I wouldn't call it a riot, but people were chucking bottles at the ring, bombarding Shawn Michaels with, like, you know, objects, and he was healing it up. He was seeking that response from the audience. I mean, he was loving it. So I mean, that was quite an occasion as well, to see Davey lose to Shawn, you know, in the UK, and lose the European title. So, I mean, you're right, he never achieved those heights again of SummerSlam 92, but I think he did have a few highlights in 97. Sadly, you know, once he joined WCW, it was all over. He had all the health problems, the drug problems, you know, his body basically, you know, self-destructed. But he'd had such a, I knew people in WCW back in the day. And I remember when he joined WCW and they pushed him and he had that little feud with Vader, Slamboree 93.
Yeah.
And even then, Davey was having all sorts of problems with his knees, all sorts of problems with his back. And this is 93, you know, like years, you know, before things really fell apart in 99 with that famously poor run when he returned and he shouldn't have even been in the ring. So, but yeah, I mean, yeah, I know what you mean. Yeah. He could never replicate that. He could never, that was the zenith of his career, undoubtedly, SummerSlam 92. As I said, you know, it was one of the most amazing matches and atmospheres and performances ever. So there's a lot of people who in their entire careers never reached that level of fame and brilliance and being a household name, which Davey literally was. You remember in 92, Davey Boy Smith was a household name in the UK.
Absolutely. I mean, he was everywhere. Yeah.
How many WWE wrestlers today are household names? I don't think any are.
No. But you know, on the flip side, you know, certainly don't want to dwell on Bret Hart, but his career, he was the face of the company, 93, 94, was a five-time WWF champion and regarded as probably one of the greatest workers of all time. And probably the one man that could get the best match out of pretty much anybody, from Mr. Perfect, Davey Boy, Steve Austin, you name it, so on and so forth. But what would you say, and this is kind of like the heading going into the podcast, what would you say is the legacy of SummerSlam 92? If it does kind of give us a legacy at all, what would you say it would be then, Finn?
Well, I mean, obviously, you know, Davey's victory, that was a thing we all remember. But you are right. It's very interesting how, you know, Davey Boy Smith and Bret Hart, it seemed like Davey's star was shining so brightly, and obviously it was that night, but he very quickly learned when he got back to the States that he was going to be dropping the IC title to Shawn Michaels, who was the big project. And Davey had only won the belt because the event was held in the UK. I mean, as we said earlier, had SummerSlam taken place in Landover, Maryland, Davey probably would have just been in like a, you know, mid-card match. So for him, it had to be bittersweet, you know, that he'd achieved this amazing moment in his life, you know, this point that he could never again, you know, reach again. And then to be told when he returned to the States, are you going to be losing the belt to Shawn Michaels in October? And I know for a fact that he was not happy about that. And that was one of the reasons, obviously, he ended up losing his job with WWF, because Vince found out that he'd been buying human growth hormone to circumvent WWF's very real and very stringent drug testing program at the time. So he was fired by Vince, along with Ultimate Warrior as well. He also lost his job, and they were both getting the drugs from the same doctor, who I believe was in England or somewhere in Europe anyway. So, you know, but I think between losing the belt, you know, had he not been fired, I think it's possible Davey would have left the company anyway. Yeah. I think he was so disgruntled, you know, that he'd gone from hero, not to zero, but certainly fallen down the card pretty quickly. And then Brett put Davey over in this incredible performance. And then almost, I think it was about 2 weeks before Davey lost the IC belt, Brett defeated Flair to become WWF champion for the first time.
Saskatoon, Canada. Yeah, that's right.
I think it was October 12th, 1992, I believe. That's correct. So it was, yeah, amazing how their careers went in opposite directions.
Yeah.
But that's pro wrestling for you. And obviously Vince saw a lot in Brett, saw this amazing performance. And it was, you know, and it was also not just the amazing in-ring performance, it was also the emotion he brought, the way he handled himself with the whole story with his sister and, you know, Davey being his brother-in-law and the family involvement and all these other things. He thought, well, maybe this guy can be world champ. You know, Ric Flair at this point was, you know, his career was very much in decline in WWF. It had peaked really at Royal Rumble that year. He was already making noises, I think, about returning to WCW. So Brett seemed like the guy to take over from Flair. I mean, in pro wrestling, it's just, this is just the way it works, isn't it? Sometimes it's your time, and events and circumstances and things occur that can either be beneficial or detrimental for you. And sometimes a performer has no control over that. But you're right, yeah, it's weird looking back on SummerSlam. And you just think, oh, look at Davey, you know, he's going to be like this huge star for years to come. And, you know, within 3 months, he'd lost his job and was gone. Within like 6-7 weeks, Bret Hart's WWF heavyweight champion. So that's what I think of really when I think of SummerSlam and the aftermath of it and the consequences or ramifications of it in terms of the story advancement, what it did for the people there. I think the legacy of SummerSlam is that it was this amazing stadium show. And WWF drew its largest ever crowd. And you know, it's this legendary show for reasons that it was the first time the company had attempted a stadium show in the UK. They'd sold it out with over 80,000 in attendance, did huge merchandise business that night. Newspapers, it was front page, newspapers, the Red Tops were covering it on the front page. You know, it just felt like WWF wrestling was... you know, could it get any bigger than this? And of course, it was never going to get bigger than that during that period. But I think in many ways, it did get bigger than that during the Attitude Era.
Yeah,
certainly got a lot bigger for me because my magazine sold a hell of a lot more copies in the late 90s than it did in 92.
Well, let's we've covered SummerSlam 92, and it's an utterly fascinating conversation because, and if you haven't gone and checked out the pay-per-view or checked out that main event recently, please do so, because it is approaching its 30th anniversary, and it is that main event alone is fantastic. Re-released it on the exact 30th anniversary, which, as me and Finn were discussing off air, is a little bit of a strange date to release it on, but it's a beautiful cover. And
obviously on the Blu-ray, it does no sign of Warrior and Savage. It's all Brett versus Davey.
Absolutely.
You know, the images on the front cover of the DVD and the Blu-ray, which, you know, just illustrates or confirms what we've been saying, that was the main event to this market.
Absolutely, absolutely. Let's talk about your career as a journalist, as a wrestling writer, and Power Slam or Superstars of Wrestling. But when did you start your kind of love for journalism, for writing? And when did you mix that with pro wrestling? When did you decide that you wanted to mix that with your love for the great sport?
Well, I mean, I became a WWF fan. I always remember the first match I watched was Strike Force versus Demolition from WrestleMania 4. And this was when I would have been 18 at the time. And yeah, I must have been 18 at the time. And we watched it in the video room. When I was on the YTS scheme, I was on this dreadful course, like this computer course. And during the lunchtime, one of the people on the course, he was a WWF fan, he had cable and he was a huge fan of Crockett Promotions and WWF and I think Mid-South. I can't remember, all these other promotions used to be on cable. It's kind of hard to believe they were, but he assured me they were. So he brought this WWF wrestling tape in. And I think, you know, I'd seen Hogan in Rocky III. I remember the wrestling scene from Highlander. That was probably pre-88. Yeah. So I'd seen little bits of American wrestling, but didn't. I think I might have seen it when it was shown on Saturday afternoons as well, when they're on this rotating cycle after Crabtree's lost the contract and then Dixon got the deal. And occasionally American wrestling would be shown on Saturday afternoons on ITV. So I had some awareness of it, but I was not a fan. And we were sat there in the TV room watching this match. And I was just blown away by Demolition versus Strikeforce. I was like, wow, this is just amazing. And I was just like, we start talking. We became like pals. And I was asking all about wrestling. And I was just like devouring all these, you know, it was like a sponge, you know, soaking up all the knowledge and everything. So I ended up in the magazine business later that year. And the guy I worked for was somebody who would put a magazine out on pretty much anything if there was money to be made. So it came to late 91, and WWF wrestling by this point is huge. Magazines are everywhere. You remember this. You know, absolutely. There's so many wrestling magazines on the shelves. So I said to the guy, why don't you put out a wrestling magazine? I'll write it. I'd never written anything since I was at school. I didn't have a clue. And he got back to me and said, yeah, you could. We'll start it. Next month, I think it was January 92, it's going to be called Superstars of Wrestling. You can write it. So that was how it started. There it is, the poster magazine.
There we go. And,
I didn't do the cover, by the way. If you look at the cover of that, there's some errors on it. I'm not responsible for those errors, but I am responsible for the errors inside.
All right.
That one. Oh my God.
It's all a learning curve, I'm sure.
very steep learning curve. So that's how it started. And I thought it'd last maybe six issues. And he published it for, I think, 24 issues, I think it was. He published it for about 2 years. And issue 25, I think, was the first one. Anyway, it was about 2 years he published it for. And he just rang me up and said, Finley, it's not working. It's not making any money. My business partner and I, we were like, he convinced me, Finley, we can do this. So we basically bought the magazine from him. We went and had meetings with magazine distributors. We put out, I think, three more issues of Superstars of Wrestling, then relaunched it as Power Slam in July of 94. So we wanted to keep the old name, Superstars of Wrestling, but they just said, forget it. You've got to change the name of the title. Problem was, we didn't really have any money to promote it properly. So by just putting it out under the old name, the trade wouldn't be excited about it. By changing the name, it was a new magazine to them, even though it was essentially the same magazine inside. So they were more likely to take more copies and we would have a better chance of making it and selling some copies and staying in business. But you know, to answer your question, I had not written anything since school. I was 22 when Superstars of Wrestling began. I hadn't written anything since I was 16. So the magazine, Superstars of Wrestling, I can't look at those issues. I cannot look at them because they're so poorly written by me. So it took a long time to really learn the biz and really learn how to write about it and understand the nuances and the minutiae of it and all these other things. I mean, I did a podcast a couple of months ago and I just, first time I sort of admitted and said, I remember it was the summer of 2007 when I really felt like I knew what I was on about.
Really?
So it took me about 15 and a half years to really learn the bits. That's how long I think it took me.
That's incredible. That's incredible. And a curious question from me. Obviously, after Superstars of Wrestling, you started Power Slam in 94, continued that for 20 years. But did being a writer of a wrestling magazine, especially with the vast amount of hours that you would put in and kind of burning the midnight oil to try and reach your deadlines, not just for one episode, but for one edition, but for 20 years worth of Power Slam, did it change your feelings on pro wrestling? How did it affect your love for the business or for your fandom as a wrestling fan? Did it kind of turn you against the business at all? Did you hate wrestling after a while?
Many times, yeah. There was quite a few moments there where I was really struggling with it. And I should say that I would put the hours in. One of the reasons why I would spend so many hours writing it was because I was not a good writer. So it would take me, I would have to sit there and write something, and then you'd rewrite it, and then you'd rewrite it again. And you're like, right, that ending doesn't work. I need to rewrite it again. So everything would just take so long. And that was really one of those sort of light bulb moments, you know, in the mid-2000s, where it just came, you know, this instinct for what to write, and it was just then natural. It wasn't a struggle. It wasn't like pulling teeth. And any subject, you knew how to approach it and you knew how to do it properly, and you know, you'd have that start, that middle and that end, and you'd know how to phrase it. You'd have that experience, that knowledge and the wisdom. You know, as when I said earlier, it takes 15 and a half years to learn the biz. I actually really think it does take that long to really learn wrestling, and some people might scoff at that, I think that's ridiculous, but I think it really does take that long to really know it and understand it and know your history and you know why things happen and why, more importantly, why things don't happen. But yeah, it was a big part of the reason why I would spend so many hours on it, because it was a struggle for me to get it right. And I had eventually had a lot of pride in my work. I mean, I had a lot of pride in my work at the beginning. You know, that was all I was capable of. If you look at those Superstars of Wrestling early issues. But certainly as the years passed and you realized, you know, it's the old confidence of ignorance thing where that will carry you through. And that's just something you generally have in life, you know, in many fields of, you know, lines of work or things that you do, you go into them and you're full of beans and you're really enthused. And it's like not knowing is actually beneficial, because if you realize how little you know, you'd be terrified of what you were doing. You know, but for me, it was, there was no one telling me what to write. You know, there was no one above me saying, oh, Finley, that's garbage, rewrite it. It was on the job. It was trial by fire. It was on the job training. But certainly as the years passed and you learned more, you understood the business more and you learned how to write things properly, then you would put a lot of effort into it and you'd get it as good as you could get it before it was sent to the printers. Mm. But it was, you know, that pursuit of not perfection, because I don't think as a writer you can ever hit that. You can never reach that. I never have and never will. And it's always a learning curve, and you should always have that drive and determination to improve what you do and become a better writer and to push yourself. That's my philosophy anyway. I know some people don't have that, but that's mine. Yeah. But that's why it took me so long to do the magazine, because I wanted it to be as good as it could be. And obviously there's some people out there that just knock it together and just, you know, put it out there for public consumption without, you know, a huge amount of effort or care. And, you know, in 2022, I can understand why. Because it's very difficult to make money out of writing about wrestling in 2022. So I can understand why somebody wouldn't want to spend 6 hours writing, you know, a 500-word piece. They'd want to complete it in 30 minutes because if the money's not there, you know, that we're all motivated by money to some extent. We've all got bills to pay. And, you know, if you cannot afford to spend 6 hours on something, you can literally only afford to spend 1 hour on it. I totally understand that. For me, when I was doing the magazine, it was, I'm going to put every hour I've got I'm going to make this thing as good as it can be, in the hopes that one day, you know, that people will recognize that, more people will buy it because they'll think it's a good publication, the sales will go up, it will become a viable business, you know, just, you know, that makes sense, surely.
Absolutely, absolutely. And, you know, it lasted 20 years. And for me, one of the reasons why I loved it and why I purchased pretty much every single edition of Power Slam magazine was it was a bit of a peek behind the curtain. And certainly for me, you know, it told me about the real life dramas behind the scenes. It kind of wasn't a kayfabe magazine, didn't give you the same storylines you would see in the WWF magazine, certainly not. But, you know, it's very forthright. Had the kind of opinions that I was after from your various writers about the wrestling landscape around the world. But why do you think it had that fascination and that appeal when it lasted for 20 years? It had a lot of longevity there that a lot of wrestling magazines of that era, certainly the 90s and 2000s, did not have then.
Well, mostly because I was doing a lot of the work, well, at the beginning, all the work. And as the years passed, I would do the typesetting, you know, source the pictures, you know, do the advert, you know, sell the ads, you know, all the, you know, I would do the production side of it. So I did a lot of things that saved money. And at the beginning, you know, it's run pretty much on a shoestring budget. So it didn't really need to make that much money in order for it to continue to exist. Also, as you know, we were running the premium rate hotlines and they did very well, really from the first week, well, probably from the 3 or 4 weeks in. We started them in late 92. The peak of them would have been about 97. And obviously when the internet arrived, most people in the UK had the internet by 2000, I guess. And the internet just eroded the business of the hotlines, because people didn't need to ring the hotline anymore to get the information. They could get it online. But, you know, the hotlines had a great run, no complaints.
Well, for many years, I know all about that, but I'll get onto that in a moment.
But for many years, the hotline was keeping the magazine afloat. That was the reason why we did the magazine, was because the hotline was a very viable business, whereas Superstars of Wrestling and then Power Slam, for many years, certainly 95, 96 wasn't. And in fact, in October 96, I moved down to Maidstone and I figured the magazine was going to go out of business in 97. So my whole plan was I was going to close the magazine in 97 and then try and get a job in London, figuring I could commute because it's about an hour Maidstone to London. And I knew people in Maidstone. So that was the reason why I chose Maidstone. So, you know, but that was the reason why, is that the costs were kept to a minimum. I was doing a lot of the work, at times nearly all the work. And other magazines, if they were run by large publishing houses, they would have to sell a certain number of copies in order for that publishing house to feel that it was worth the investment. Because the magazine, if it's a large publishing house, the magazine doesn't have to just pay for itself. It's got to pay for lots of staff there as well. And if that magazine is not producing enough revenue to, you know, hit certain marks in terms of revenue creation, then they'll close the title and they'll put that time and resources and money into another title that could potentially make enough money for a large publishing house to justify the investment of time and, you know, staff. So that's another reason as well. But yeah, look, I mean, there was obviously lots of magazines around in, you know, during the original craze era, and then most of them closed. Well, American ones still existed, but most of the UK ones went under. And then, as sure as you can recall very clearly, the Attitude Era, the big boom of 98, that led to another massive influx of magazines. There were so many wrestling magazines available in 98, 99, 2000. And then I'm sure you remember as well, look, once WCW went under, ECW went, you know, and WWF kind of passed its peak in mid-2001, quite a few of those titles disappeared.
Yeah.
And again, for the same reason, because they just weren't generating enough revenue. You know, in short, Power Slam for many years was a labor of love for me, and other magazines existed purely as business ventures, you know, just as money-making propositions. And when they weren't making money, the publishers dropped them. That's the way the world works.
There we go. There we go. And I think one of the key features that I would really, really enjoy reading in your editions of Power Slam with the interviews, Finn. And I know that you've released subsequently a lot of those interviews in the Power Slam Interviews Volume 1 and Volume 2. But in those separate editions and throughout the magazine over the years, you interviewed the likes of Bruno Sammartino, Mick Foley, let's say just days or weeks after his Hell in a Cell match, Austin, Brian Pillman, Harley Race, and so many more. What are some of your standout memories or some of your favourite memories from some of the interviews that you've had over the years?
Yeah, I should point out that quite a few of those interviews were done by other people like Greg Lambert, you know, Oliver Hurley, Danny Flexen, people like that. So, you know, other people did those, did the interviews. It wasn't just me. But for me personally, I mean, the Brian Pillman one in 96, that was a big one.
Because that was around the time when he was the loose cannon character, wasn't it? That was when he was really throwing everybody off and making them second guess whether it was a work or a shoot. But very interesting.
Well, it was the timing of it. It was one day before he signed with WWF.
Right.
He signed with WWF the next day. So that was an amazing interview. And it was just to do the interview with him at that time. And, you know, he was, I remember him saying, you know, have you got some good pictures for this? I said, yeah, I have. I'm going to put you on the cover. And he was really pleased. He was really chuffed about that. And so that was a big one. That's in the Power Slam Interviews Volume 2.
That's possibly the cover there, is it? Or
no, that was sadly, that was after he died.
Ah, of course.
Yeah, issue 24, I think it was, the Pillman
right.
one. Another big one was the first Chris Jericho one in 99. And that was really the interview where, you know, the magazine came out of the closet in terms of kayfabe. You know, we were writing openly about pro wrestling being a work. And that was a 6-page interview I did with Chris. And he was a really great guy. You know, he had a lot of time for the magazine. And that was shortly before he signed with WWF. So I remember that one very clearly as well. He was so disillusioned with WCW. You know, he wouldn't say that he was going to sign with WWF, but it was fairly obvious from the tone of the interview that that was his direction of travel. Other big ones, I mean, Steve Austin in the Superstars. No, that actually was Power Slam, issue 6 of Power Slam.
94 when you interviewed Austin, yeah.
Yeah, that was a really good one because he was in character at the time and that was just a lot of fun. You mentioned the Foley one. That was took place, I think it was about 3 or 4 weeks after Hell in a Cell.
That's right.
Yeah, I mean, that was a big one. So we talked a lot about the match and all sorts of other things and WWF.
That was my favourite interview. That was my favourite, certainly.
That was a good one. I mean, you know, Mick and I had a bit of a falling out. You know, Mick didn't like Power Slam after I won't go into the reasons why, but... You know, Mick had a lot of time for Power Slam and Superstars Wrestling back in the day. He doesn't really have a lot of time for... He didn't have a lot of time for Power Slam in later years, but, you know, I absolutely appreciate the fact that he made the time for the magazine that he did. I'll always be grateful to him for that. So that was a heck of an interview. Another really good one was... I actually interviewed New Jack twice. First time in 2000, and that was wild. That was a wild interview talking about his days as a bounty hunter, working for Smoky Mountain, you know, in Memphis, ECW. And yeah, he was quite a character. You know, you would argue with him on the phone, he'd get really angry with you. But he was somebody that he just didn't care what he said. And then I interviewed him again in 2012. And that was probably the craziest interview I ever did. That was just the disclosures in that interview. You know, just the whole, you know, the Vic Grimes thing at the XPW Freefall event, you know, the massive scaffold match, things he said about that and his criminal activities. And, you know, that was really eye-opening. And I've been doing the job a long time by that point.
Absolutely.
And that was still like, wow, this is really alarming. This is going to make a hell of an interview. And I always remember there was about 4 topics of conversation that I couldn't include in the magazine. If you read that interview, it is incendiary. And there was a load of topics I couldn't include because they simply weren't suitable for an audience of an audience that was under 18.
Absolutely. And like I say, you can check out that and many more of the interviews that we've just discussed. The Power Slam interviews, Volume 1 and Volume 2, available. I think I got my copies via Amazon. I downloaded them onto Prime, onto my Kindle, onto your device. So very, very easily accessible. But Finn, an incredible kind of longevity with Power Slam. And you mentioned earlier, and I better tell my audience my story about the Power Slam hotline, because going back to when I purchased the SummerSlam tickets, my family at the time didn't have a home phone. We probably didn't get a home phone until the mid-90s, probably 96. So I would want to listen to the PowerSlam hotline, of course. So I would have to trudge on down to the nearest what you call them, phone box.
They're now like many of them now are like libraries, aren't they?
But I'd be popping pound coins into it just to get through. I mean, sometimes they were like 10 or 15 minute recordings from Finn, you know, give us all the latest information. But it was every penny was well spent. And I don't regret a single pound coin that I popped into them phone boxes to listen to the Power Slam podcast. And then I think I was the one that convinced my dad to get a phone for the house in the end, just to save us a few quid. Absolutely fantastic. I mean, over your time, your 22 years with the Superstars of Wrestling, so as a magazine writer and editor, what are some of the standouts, some of the proudest moments that you've accomplished within that time, and probably even, you know, more recent times, because I know that you've been doing the podcast with Kenny for 6 years now, but what are some of the proudest memories that you have of being a wrestling journalist?
I just like to say I appreciate the fact that you ran the hotline. And, you know, you were one of the people that magazine in business back in...
I know.
Bad old days.
Yeah.
Well, that's no exaggeration. I suppose some of the interviews are mentioned. I remember the first time I went to America to see ECW. We saw CyberSlam with the famous Brian Pillman appearance.
Mm.
That was quite something. That was really when the loose cannon thing was just getting going. And like doing that story in the magazine, that felt like an achievement. It felt like, wow, I'm actually wasn't just going to a local show and then doing like a review of that local show. This was going to the States and going to see ECW and going into the, you know, the hallowed ECW arena and then coming back and doing like the story on it. And it felt like, wow, Power Slam's a proper magazine, you know. And that was the thing there. That felt pretty good. And I remember going over to Orlando and Daytona Beach in 97 for Bash at the Beach 97 and the subsequent Monday Nitro. That felt pretty big as well, doing the story on that. Same with Halloween Havoc 99. Went to Vegas, saw that live. Halloween Havoc 99, which was Vince Russo and Ed Ferrara's first pay-per-view for WCW when they were in charge. So that felt pretty big as well. But there's all sorts of things. You know, just the fact that the magazine made it. You know, the big one really was issue 40. I mean, I said earlier that I thought in late 96 the magazine was going to go out of business in 97. Happily, as we know, the wrestling business made this amazing comeback in 1997. That was when WWF had that year of rebuilding, you know, and I think WrestleMania 13 was really the catalyst for that, with the Hart heel turn, the Austin babyface turn, you know, just the growth that the company experienced creatively and later financially that year. And that was really reflected in our sales that summer. And it just felt like the whole business had much more of a buzz and more people getting back into it. People who hadn't watched wrestling in years was suddenly finding time in their weekly schedules to watch it again, because it was different. The product had grown up, you know, it was borrowing a lot from ECW and it just felt more topical, didn't it? It was more in tune with pop culture, and it, it just felt like it was, you know, cool again, wrestling, or at least to people who, you know, we watched it all along. But a lot of people then kind of rediscovered it. And obviously WCW was riding high with the NWO and the Cruiserweights and their product, which was really, you know, quite exhilarating to watch as well each week. And the whole Nitro versus Raw thing. And people forget, don't they, just how many viewers WCW and WWF were drawing in the UK. Some weeks it'd be like 250,000, 300,000 people would watch Raw. And then the same, you know, similar number would watch Nitro. It was hugely popular.
Staggering numbers, yeah.
Yeah, hugely popular. I remember, look, you go back and look at the figures and you're like, are they for real? And I'm sure they were. So it just felt like the business was heating up again. And, you know, I remember issue 40 that year, we did our first promotion. You just had the issue up with Pillman on the cover. Sadly, it was also featured the Brian Pillman obituary. And we did our first proper promotion with a supplement. We spent like thousands of pounds on it because the business was doing well, put more copies out there. Sales went up and it just felt like the magazine was going somewhere for so many years in like late 94. Because like when we launched Power Slam, the first two issues did well. And issue 3 fell off a cliff. Issue 4, sales declined further. And like, oh my God, is this magazine going to last a year? Is it going to be out of business by December 94? And happily, the sales figures stabilized. They didn't drop any further. And it increased slightly in 95, ever so slightly in 96. But as I said, you know, there was a lot of fear there that this magazine wasn't going to be around much longer. It was going to go out of business in 97. And on the contrary, you know, the sales increased. And then by this point, I'd learned the magazine business. And that was another thing I was saying earlier about, oh, it took me all these years to learn how to become a writer. But also it was learning the magazine business as a publisher because I was publishing the magazine. So there's all these things that you have to learn as you go along. And they involve spending money and you want to get it right because it's your money. And if you don't really have any money or you're borrowing money, you want to make sure you want to give yourself the best possible chance that whatever strategy or, you know, promotion you're going to do is going to succeed. Otherwise, it could sink you. But yeah, that was a huge turning point, was issue 40 of Power Slam, sales going up. And then issue 41 was the Montreal Double Cross issue. People were fascinated. People couldn't work out what happened. Sales went up again. You know, issue 42, by this point, the PS50 was established, our annual rankings. And this point, was a magazine seller. So people who wouldn't buy every issue would always buy the PS50 because he wanted to read the list that, you know, that we compiled of the top 50, you know, in-ring performers in the game. So 42 did really well. Issue 43 was January 98. That was coverage of Sting winning the title at Starrcade 97. Obviously a dreadful show, but WCW's biggest ever show, and it was the culmination of the Sting Hogan. Well, actually, it wasn't the culmination. It was kind of led to a lot of confusion, very muddled. Let's not get into that.
No.
So then, you know, and then what happened next? Raw Rumble 98. Then night after that, we had the Tyson versus Austin angle. To me, still the greatest angle of all time. And then we're on the road to WrestleMania 14. And that was an amazing time to be covering wrestling.
Yeah.
Because you could just feel that, you know, there was this, it was a sea change. You know, there was this massive groundswell of support. And it just almost felt like 92 again, but in a different way. And I was in a much better position to capitalize on that because, you know, I'd had 6 years as a writer at this point. So I was more confident and knew what to do. We had the photography situation was sorted out, so we had good photographers. You know, so the magazine looked better. I was a better writer, I was a better designer. We had a small team of people who were contributing. So the whole thing just felt, you know, more, it felt more like a business. It felt more like it was something that would be built. It wasn't me struggling from issue to issue and just, as you say, burning the midnight oil and just trying to get an issue out on time and wondering which pictures I was going to use because I had so few pictures to choose from and looking at the end product and thinking, oh, that magazine doesn't look very good. Who's going to buy that? by 98, because you've got things in place and you know what you're doing, or you've got more of a grasp and an understanding of how to put a magazine out, the magazine goes on sale, you pick it up, and you start to have a bit of pride in what you're doing, because you realize that you're making progress and your sales are going up. One thing feeds another, and you know, your readers are more enthusiastic about the title because they can see the magazine's getting better, and you've got more money to spend on photos, and then you can do another supplement and blah, blah, blah. And it just all progresses. And
yeah,
it's the whole thing of building a business. When you're making money, you reinvest that money and you grow the business. And I think really the two achievements really that stand out are, one, building the business. And there were so many times when it looked like it wasn't going to make it, and it did, and it became a success. And secondly, and this is the thing I'm probably most proud of, and this won't mean a whole lot to anyone other than people who worked on the magazine, was I'm a big believer in trickle-down economics. A lot of people say that doesn't exist, and it's this capitalist fantasy. Well, it damn well existed on PowerSlam, because when that magazine was making money, a lot of that money got passed on to the people who worked on it. And that's really ultimately the thing I'm most proud of, that I looked after the staff and I paid them well. You get Christmas bonuses. At its peak, they were getting a Christmas bonus, the staff, and they were getting an end of tax year bonus. The printers got Christmas bonuses. The color originators got a Christmas bonus. And a lot of that money got passed on to people. You know, I felt like I paid very fairly. And in fact, I remember on the day when I had to ring everyone up to tell them that I was closing the title, and that was a long day. And I didn't speak to everyone. I think it was one person I didn't speak to. I spoke to one photographer in Canada, he'd seen it coming. He knew. He actually worked in the magazine business, and it'd been very difficult for him out there. And I remember him saying, "Finlay, have you thought about paying us less? Because you pay us very well." And I said, "I'm not having a race to the bottom here. I'm not cutting corners. I'm not cutting costs. And I'm not expecting people to work for less than I want to pay them. So I would rather the magazine went out when it still had a budget and it still looked like PowerSlam, rather than trimming costs to the bone and, you know, trying to eke out a few more months of this thing." So, and I've got, you know, no real regrets at all about closing the title, because I didn't want to do that. I didn't want to say to people, "Well, I can only afford to pay you half of what I was paying you 3 months ago." I just didn't have the heart to do that. So that's my favorite achievement from the magazine, is running a business and looking after the staff.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And it's been fascinating talking to you for an hour and a half now, Finlay, if you can believe that. Like I say, we've kind of given our kind of in-depth thoughts and memories of SummerSlam 92 as we approach its 30th anniversary. And you mentioned earlier, Clash of the Castle just around the corner, less than 2 weeks away now. I'll be there in Cardiff. I'm not sure if you will be, but I'm sure you'll be watching it nonetheless. But with recent changes within WWE, certainly within the creative department and management areas within WWE, I think, I don't know if you'll agree with me here, but I feel a lot more optimistic about the direction of WWE now, certainly creatively. The programs are a lot more watchable on a weekly basis, Raw and SmackDown. And I think, I'd say Clash of the Castle will be Triple H's first full pay-per-view or premium live event that he's been fully in charge of. But a very exciting future for that company.
Yeah, I mean, it's obviously Vince, you know, retiring, was just astounding that it came to that. But
yeah,
when you understand and can see the reasons, then he didn't really have much choice. He had to go, and Paul Levesque's taken over. I think he's the right man for the job. He's basically been training for this role for well over 20 years. And certainly it was 2010, wasn't it, when he went part-time.
Yeah.
So with NXT and his, you know, executive duties, he's well-versed in how this company works, you know, not just creatively, but in terms of business as well. So, yeah, I mean, I've been impressed with what he's done so far. I like the fact that, just like the Intercontinental title, 2 weeks ago on SmackDown, it was the main event, Gunther versus Nakamura. And it just felt like it was the first time in so many years that the IC title felt like something akin to what Bret and Davey Boy Smith were fighting over back at SummerSlam 92. And you're like, wow, this match matters. You know, this championship matters because of the way they positioned it in the main event slot. And I've got to say, the following week on SmackDown, this past Friday SmackDown, they had a five-way match, Sami Zayn versus Sheamus versus Madcap Moss versus Ricochet. Happy Corbin, yeah.
Yeah.
And that was a long match, really well assembled, so much noise, such a buoyant atmosphere from the fans in Montreal, who really behind Sami Zayn, who I think is also somebody who's going to be a great beneficiary of Paul Levesque's creative. I mean, Sami Zayn's just, you can see he's about to turn babyface, and I think it's going to be really good for him. And I like the fact that Sheamus won that match. It would have been the easiest thing in the world to give Sami Zayn that win on that night, but that would have been rushing the story.
Yeah.
And this is all, you know, let's just see how this story progresses with Sami.
And when you think about opponents for Walter in Cardiff, or Gunter in Cardiff, Sheamus, you know, you can imagine the battle those two are going to have.
Exactly. So Sheamus won. I mean, he's from Ireland, but I mean, that's fairly close to Wales. And I mean, that could be a heck of a match between those two. And it just feels like the IC title is back. And there were other things as well, like bringing, you know, the tournament for the Women's Tag Team Championship, which was vacated by Sasha Banks and Naomi, as people know. And, you know, using NXT talent, JC Jane and Gigi Dolan were on SmackDown this past Friday. I thought there was actually one pretty rough spot actually between Sonya and Dolan. But after that, they calmed down. You know, they found the rhythm and the match was a good match. I really enjoyed that. But there's lots of little things happening, like Ricochet. You know, he's back from the dead as well. I mean, he looked like somebody was about to be released from his contract, and now he feels like a somebody again. But there's so many things happening that I think give me optimism that WWE is in safe hands. Yeah, I couldn't agree more.
Absolutely. But before we let you go, Finn, we know that you're very busy writing for Inside the Ropes magazine. You're still one of the co-hosts alongside Kenny McIntosh on the fantastic Power Slam podcast. And what's going down? Power Slam, obviously, the Power Slam podcast celebrates its sixth anniversary week.
5 years. 5 years.
Sixth anniversary. My apologies. Yeah, yeah. But don't want to kind of over-exaggerate things like we do in wrestling. Tell us where we can get hold of your books, buy the Inside the Ropes magazine, listen to your podcast. Plug away, my friend. The floor is yours.
Yeah, well, the books, you've shown the covers. They're all available from Amazon, Pro Wrestling Through the Power Slam Years, 1994, 2014, Power Slam Interviews Volume 1 and 2. They're available on Kindle from Amazon, also from Apple as well. The magazine, Inside the Ropes magazine, which is here, as I said earlier, issue 24, goes on sale this Thursday. So that's available from Smith's throughout the UK and other countries as well. And we do What's Going Down, as you said, the Power Slam podcast, they're available. Where all good podcasts are available from.
Absolutely.
So, just do a search and that will come up. But yeah, we record What's Going Down on Tuesday, and we record the Power Slam podcast on Thursday. So that's weekly. And we do all sorts of stuff on Fright Inside the Ropes on Patreon. We're doing a review of SummerSlam 2002 this Thursday. So Kenny and Sondra, they do like retro reviews for Inside the Ropes Patreon. And I join them monthly for it's now WWE, for the pay-per-view recording. So it's like a three-person review analysis of that retro, that vintage pay-per-view. But yeah, I'm really looking forward to reviewing SummerSlam 2002 this Thursday, because I mean, that was a hell of a show. Sure, you remember
it was indeed, yes, Brock. Another very memorable SummerSlam.
Absolutely. So is that, and we do all sorts of stuff. There's you know, all sorts of podcasts. And like, I remember after the Vince retirement, we did like an emergency podcast the next morning. You know, it is, if a story breaks, you've got to act, you've got to get on it, haven't you?
So, absolutely, absolutely. But I love listening to the Inside the Ropes podcast. I love listening to yourself and Kenny on the Power Slam podcast and What's Going Down. Certainly the two podcasts that are kind of on my phone, and I get the notifications when they come through. But Finlay Martin, it's been a pleasure, an honour to have you on Wrestling with Jonas episode 256. I want to thank you so much for coming on the show this week.
Well, thank you for having me, and I'm glad that my voice held up. There was a few moments there when we were about 32 minutes in, and I thought, oh no, I'm in trouble. But my voice held up. I'm pleased about that. Thanks to everyone for watching and for listening. Does this go out as audio as well? Do you put this out as an audio?
It will do. It will be dropping tomorrow, so just 24 hours after the live feed. So, yeah, it'll be going out on all audio platforms, just like the Inside the Ropes podcast. This can be found absolutely everywhere anyway. But Finlay Martin, thank you so much for your time.
Thank you for having me.